Welcome to the Rooney Report. Today we have with us Sean Carney, co-founder of 40 Days for Life. Sean, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. Now, if you could start out by what motivated you to just get this whole thing started, the 40 Days for Life?
Well, you know, 40 Days for Life is very simple. It's 40 days of prayer and fasting and 40 days of community outreach and 40 days of a nonstop peaceful vigil outside of an abortion facility. And it really started, you know, in 2004, myself and David B. Wright, my wife, were seeing our local abortion numbers in College Station, Texas, go up. Mm-hmm. And we thought, what could we do to actually impact that? And spent an hour in prayer, and from that came this idea to do 40 Days for Life. And so we never imagined it would go anywhere. We did that first campaign and thought, well, that was nice.
Yeah,
we got the t-shirt,
yeah,
now we're done. And then cities started knocking on our door.
Cities, and now, is it 50 countries?
50 countries, yeah.
And how many cities?
777 cities in 50 different countries
now
participate in 40 Days for Life. And it's just been such a joy to see.
Right.
You know, many of these countries, America has brought abortion, introduced abortion, particularly in Africa and Latin America, and yet they also come to us for the solution.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I heard you speak last night, and you told, I thought, a really good story about a woman who had been sidewalk counseling. Her name is Paula, and a woman who apparently had an abortion was very angry and upset with Paula. And if you could just share what happened there.
Yeah, I think this really speaks to everybody who is pro-life or certainly wants to make a difference. I put this in the new book. And this woman, Paula's, you know, very laid back, calm woman, 70 years old. Everybody loves her, or at least likes her. And she would go out regularly at this huge Planned Parenthood in Orange. And she had a woman pull up and just scream at her and say, why are you here? Why are you here? And, you know, you don't know what people are going through. You don't know, you know, these women's stories. And she just sort of screamed at her, Planned Parenthood saved my life. And Paula had never heard that phrase, and I'd never heard it before, worded like that. It kind of makes you think, like, who says that, you know? And she said, well, how did Planned Parenthood save your life? And the woman just looked at her and said, I was a victim of sexual abuse, and my parents brought me here when I was 15, and they gave me an abortion. And I was able to go and get a master's degree and a job, and I've had a great life and a great career, and I never would have had those opportunities if I was raising a kid. They saved my life. And Paula thought about, you know, what she should say in response to this, and she just went with her gut feeling and looked at the woman and said, I'm so sorry that you went through that, but they didn't save your life.
Right.
They killed your baby.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman just looked at her and said, you shouldn't be here. You don't know what these people are going through. And she drove off. And Paula kind of thought, well, what should I have said? You know,
yeah,
was that the right?
Second thoughts. Yeah.
Second thoughts. And the woman came back 5 minutes later, and her demeanor had completely changed. She was like sort of sulking. And she walked up to Paula and said, where were you? Mm. Where were you? I see you out here every day.
Mm-hmm.
And no one was here for me. I was a child, and that abortion destroyed my life. My own parents forced me to have an abortion. Where were you? And it was a very powerful, you know, the wall had come down. And Paula was honest with her. She said, I was too much of a coward to come out here. I didn't take my faith seriously, and I should have been. I'm sorry that I wasn't here, that no one else was here, and I'm sorry, above all, that you went through that.
Right,
and, you know,
right.
We're here to help. And it was just a beautiful, you know, we're so divided and cynical in our society right now. And we assume, well, you have your opinion, I have my opinion, it does no good to argue. And abortion really doesn't allow us to do that. You can't just have one and then move on as if everything is fine. There's always a brokenness there and an opportunity for healing. And so it's a beautiful, that question to us, where were you? And it's a very powerful question.
Right, yeah. And I think that women who've, and I've interviewed women who've had abortions, and, you know, they go through a lot of pain. So I think the comment that Planned Parenthood saved my life is really probably a coping mechanism.
Sure.
And this counselor helped her realize the real trauma that she had gone through. And I think you said that you know, they exchange contact information, right. And that's truly what pro-life people want to do is be there to help heal those wounds and move forward.
Yeah, and that's the nature of our movement. We're definitely a movement of converts. We're a movement of people who have had an abortion. We're a movement of men who have paid for an abortion, of doctors who have done abortions. Those are the people that have flooded into the pro-life movement the last 45 years. And so, you know, that should give us great hope that these former workers, we've helped 178 abortion facility workers who've had a change of heart and left their job. Sue Thayer wrote the foreword to the book. She used to manage a Planned Parenthood, and then she led a 40 Days for Life campaign outside of her former workplace. So, you know, there's so much good going on, and it's because abortion has to answer for itself, and it can't. It's a lie, and that's why we're still trying to justify it, and that's why today, you know, more people oppose it now in America than ever before.
I think a big part of that is that, you know, there's been so much trauma and pain that I always say to women who've had an abortion that they can reach more people than I can because they've experienced that and they can help other women, you know, not make that same mistake.
Yeah, and they're very powerful sidewalk counselors. You know, one of my favorite statistics for 40 Days for Life, yes, it's gone around the world and we've seen 15,000 babies saved and all of these beautiful things, but 25% of our local campaign leaders are women who have had an abortion. And that really speaks, that's a great reflection of the pro-life movement at large. And you're right, it does give credibility, but it also gives the hope to those who are going in. You know, it's we all rejoice when a baby is saved, but the majority of them aren't. And when you're out there and you're praying, we're there in solidarity with those babies as they lose their life, but we're also there to offer hope and healing for that woman, and they're surprised. They're surprised. They expect the condemnation. They expect the judgment. And yet, you know, there's no follow-up appointment at Planned Parenthood when you have an abortion.
Yeah, I think part of the reason that they have this surprise is that oftentimes, you know, the mainstream media will cast a, you know, improper view of you know, pro-life people. Pro-life people, the people I know, you know, they truly care and they want to make a difference and they're not nasty. They don't condemn the person, you know. And you can just see this when you go to, and we talked about this earlier before the program, is if you go to an event where you see pro-life people praying and, you know, kind of the gentle meekness, and then you see the counter-protesters. I was at an event one time where the counter-protesters started a car on fire. And
that's not pro-life.
No, I know. These are the counter-protesters.
Exactly.
And you just hear the profanity.
Yeah.
And you see the anger. And then you look at the difference in it. You don't see that in mainstream media. But if you could look at those two and then, okay, which side do I want to be on? Do I want to be on the side where there's hate and anger, or do you want to be on the side that's gentle, peaceful, prayer?
Yeah. One of the encouraging things about you sharing that, that people should be motivated by, is the lack of counter-protests at most 40 Days for Life vigils. You know, this is very much a dead issue at the local level for those who support abortion. They're not going to be active in it. It's a passive position.
There is some yet, but
there's
not
some.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have places in New York and California and parts of Europe where you do get these counter protests. And you're right. It's always these irrational, crazy people that go out. And, you know, that should give us a lot of hope that when you go out for 40 Days for Life and you represent the unborn, it is pretty much a one-sided issue. You're not going to have a lot of people saying, you know, don't come out here. We're going to be out here 40 days, you know, as well to tell people how horrible you are. That there's a lack of motivation on the other side, particularly for young people. And, you know, NARAL, the largest abortion advocacy group in the country, their president resigned a few years ago, and she cited her inability to motivate young people to support abortion rights. And she was right. And she said, we are losing this.
Although the pro-abortion side puts a lot of money into their efforts, you know, to keep abortion legal throughout 9 months.
Yes.
You know, they even opposed the partial birth abortion. They're just radical. They say they're pro-choice, but they don't want to give women a choice in knowing the options. They always fight, you know, women's right to know, and they're motivated, oftentimes, not always, but by money. I mean, they make
a
lot of money.
Definitely.
And on our side, the pro-life side, you're not there. I mean, I've put hundreds of hours, and I don't make any money.
Right. You go out to your local Planned Parenthood, your local abortion facility, and there is a huge disconnect because they do put all their money in politics in Washington, D.C. But there's a huge disconnect between the marketing and the executives that run the abortion industry that come up with these phrases and those who are actually running a local abortion facility where you live. There's a huge disconnect.
Yeah.
And that is very encouraging, and we have seen that. That's why they have this exodus of workers. And many of the former directors of abortion facilities say, I was an island. I didn't get a lot of support. They have no idea that y'all are out here every day, or they just kind of blow it off. And, you know, that's a huge advantage. You know, we're from the grassroots up.
Right.
And they're not. They're very top heavy. And like you said, they put a lot of money into the big picture and into Washington. Mm-hmm. But they are hurting at the local level.
Mm-hmm. You know, you talk about phrases, and I just think about how they try to dehumanize the nascent child. And really, if they cared about the mother, they truly would give that mother, you know, these are your options, you know, adoption. They have less than, I think it's less than 2%. I mean, very small percentage that they refer out.
It's one adoption referral to every 125 abortions.
Yeah, less than 2%, or less than
1%.
Less than 1%. And when you talked about phrases, one time I was at the Planned Parenthood here in Minnesota, the large one, and I saw a bus for a blood center locally, and it said "Saving Lives in Your Neighborhood," and having that right next to the building, I just like, wow, you know, taking lives in your neighborhood and then saving lives in your neighborhood.
And you know, you mentioned there the motivation for money is when you go out there, your presence has an impact. Mm-hmm. The former workers, abortion workers, say that the no-show rate for an abortion appointment goes as high as 75% when people are out there. Mm-hmm. And what that means for us is, praise God, a baby is saved. What it means for them is a loss of about $400 or $500.
Right.
And that adds up. Yeah. They are a bottom line business. And you know, we've seen record numbers of abortion businesses close. They had about 70 per year the last 5 years.
That's
unprecedented.
Close. Yeah.
And so, you know, when you go out and you witness this joyfully, and people turn around, you're hurting their business. It's plain and simple as that.
I think another thing that I had heard you say is that, and for people who are, you know, thinking about going out and sidewalk counseling, it's really important to realize that when you're out there, you may save a life that you never know about. And you talked about a place in New York, Grosh, New York, where for 10 years they never thought they had saved anybody. And then what?
Yeah, no confirmation of a save, but they were just going out faithfully, knowing God would use them somehow. And then a woman pulled up this week and said, "Hey, I came in here 6 years ago, and I turned around because I saw you, and I want you to meet my six-year-old little girl." And this girl popped out of the car, and you know, it's just beautiful.
Yeah,
like you can't, you're sitting here going, "Wow, remember that time I complained because it was raining hard?" Like all that goes away.
Right,
it all goes away when you see a child who's saved from abortion. Yeah. And I think fear is the first natural response when you're invited to go do it. And most people are like, "I don't really want to do that," you know, and that's normal. I didn't want to go the first time.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a little bit of hesitation, or if you do, that's very typical. And
but you don't have, you can just go there and pray.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the being uncomfortable out there is good. People say, "Well, it can be kind of awkward," and it can be. But it's not awkward because you're there.
Mm-hmm.
It's awkward because they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's really not a lot of awkwardness unless you're out there, because then it's just business as usual, and they're in a nice building in a normal neighborhood, and this is going on inside.
A lot of people wouldn't know unless you're there.
A lot of people wouldn't know.
Yeah, yeah. This is a book that you just recently came out with, and you've got a lot of inspiring stories in here. If you could share with me one of your, and I'm sure they're all good, but one of your favorite stories from this book.
Well, I mentioned the story of Paula.
Right.
And I love her humility of saying, you know, I should have been out here. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's hard to pick favorites. We're not supposed to do that. But
well, we don't have time to do them all.
Yeah, that's right. We'll just do the audiobook here on the show. One of the very powerful ones that really speaks to the heart of the matter, it happened in Manassas, Virginia, where this abortion doctor had a pregnancy resource center next to his abortion facility, and they literally shared a wall. And then outside was a 40 Days for Life campaign. So this abortion facility was sort of surrounded by the pro-life community and by prayer.
Yeah.
And because the pregnancy center shared a wall, they could literally hear the abortions happen. They could hear the machine come on in this back room where this doctor did abortions. So they decided to turn their back room on the other side of the wall into a chapel. And they would pray. And one day there was a group there praying. They were singing. They were singing the Divine Mercy Chaplet and praying. And he could hear them through the wall. And it reminded him of his childhood faith in God.
Oh, wow.
And as between doing abortions, he could hear this singing and this praying through the wall. And he thought, what have I become?
Right.
What am I doing?
Right.
So he literally walked out to the 40 Days for Life leaders who were outside and said, I think I need to see a priest.
Wow.
And at first they thought, he's pulling our leg, or he's kind of harassing us,
yeah,
you know, because
exactly,
there had been some of that there.
Trying to make fun.
Exactly. Yeah. And then they realized from his body language he was serious, and they actually walked into the pregnancy center with the abortion doctor. The lady at the front of the pregnancy center nearly had a heart attack. Like, what in the world is happening?
Yeah.
And they exchanged information, and that man did see a priest. He never did another abortion. And that facility ended up closing.
Wow.
And it was a beautiful way of, you know, you think,
and now he's preaching in favor of life.
He was promoting life. I mean, he was doing abortions, and actually doing them in the middle of the process. He had a change of heart, and you know, we that is the cross. That is why we put all of our faith and trust in Calvary, that is possible. And it's a beautiful story, and it represents, you know, I mentioned there's been 178 abortion facility workers that have had a change of heart and left their job. We have to trust the mercy of Christ, and we need his mercy. That's what this boils down to, is we are dependent upon him for his mercy.
You know, years ago I met Bernard Nathanson, and he was in the very beginning of the pro-abortion movement and had done thousands of them, and he had a conversion, and the last years of his life, he, you know, after he converted, he promoted the sanctity of life. And I interviewed another a long-term, I guess, pro-life hero, you could call him, Joe Scheidler.
Yes.
And we were talking about Nathanson, and I know Scheidler encouraged you quite a bit.
Oh, right? He's been called accurately the godfather of the pro-life movement.
Right, yeah.
Which is a great title.
So anyhow, we were talking about Nathanson, and Scheidler told me that, you know, when Nathanson first, kind of like this doctor, you know, first changed, he was questioning it, just like at the crisis pregnancy center,
sure.
They were questioning it. And then Nathanson said he still wasn't sure, you know, how sincere, Scheidler said he wasn't sure how sincere Nathanson was. And then he said he met with Nathanson and Dr. Nathanson said to Scheidler, you know, I can't really come to grips with this. And, you know, suicide ran in his family.
Sure.
So that's why he appeared to be, you know, like not as enthusiastic as he would normally be, but he had to guard himself, because if he could, and I know he, you know, he had forgiveness and all that, but it was just a fascinating story.
It's a very difficult thing, you know. I mean, and Abby Johnson was a Planned Parenthood director.
Right.
She walked directly into my office. I knew her 8 years when she worked at the Planned Parenthood in our city. And I never questioned her sincerity because of how we ended, because I knew her for 8 years.
Yeah,
and I think that would have been hard. If she had come in my office and started crying and said, I can't do this anymore, I would have only had to trust that moment.
Right.
And and that is what she did.
Yeah.
But, you know, I knew her for so long that I knew this is a woman that wears everything on her sleeve. She doesn't, she's not trying to manipulate anything. She would tell us if she's happy
she's
or mad.
Right,
we got a lot of exchanges at Planned Parenthood. And so I was like, this is genuine. And that was it. That was a huge grace. But there is a coping mechanism. Mm-hmm. And we have a former abortion doctor on our board. And he's in the book, and I put this in the book, and he talks about his healing process. And he said, you know, I had to look at myself in the mirror and say, I'm no different than a Nazi. Mm. I killed children for money.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go to those depths to realize the great mercy that our Lord has. But he said, it's not a fun place to go.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a reality that you come to terms with.
You know, Sean, I don't know if this is in your book or not, but you talked about a woman who worked in a Planned Parenthood facility, and her epiphany, so to speak, or the moment she realized that what she was doing she could no longer do, was when she looked at an invoice.
Yes, yeah, it was a very powerful, you know, she worked at the Planned Parenthood and she was an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
She paid bills and checked the mail, and she saw this invoice from the local morgue, and it was for $300 for 150 pounds of ashes for medical waste.
Mm-hmm.
And she just, it stopped her in her tracks. All the justification, all the, well, I don't work on the east side of the building, all of that went away.
Mm-hmm.
Because she thought to herself, how many children have to be aborted?
Right, a lot, yeah.
To add up to 150 pounds of ashes. So, very powerful story. It's the third chapter of the book, and it really points to, she looked at that invoice and quit. That was it for her.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to. Some people would say, look, I work there, I have a great job, I have to provide for my family, you know, I don't know what they do, I don't want to think about it, and move on. Stiff upper lip and you move on. She didn't do that. She had a change of heart, left, and then went to work at a local pregnancy center.
Great, yeah. I think a lot of people would benefit by, like you said, sidewalk counseling, spending a little time at a crisis pregnancy center. It's easy in our society for people to just become so removed that, you know, they don't even think about. So here in Minnesota, at one building, 6,000 people die a year.
Right.
You know? And those women are wounded too. You know, sometimes they don't deal with it till decades later.
Yeah, it sits there, and a week goes by, a month goes by, a year goes by, decades go by. And that really shows the heart, I think, of the pro-life movement. You know, and we're there, yes, for the babies. We're the last hope for the babies as they're about to be aborted. But we're also the first sign of mercy when those women come out. And I tell people, and we train our leaders, your body language, what you say, what you don't say, is often what they remember for decades.
Yeah.
And they realize, you know, here it comes. They're going to tell me I'm burning in hell. And you know, when you offer free healing information, or you're just, you know, bowed down in prayer, they remember that.
Mm-hmm.
The testimonies that I've heard that really got me involved as a young, you know, 19-year-old, were from those post-abortive women. And they all said, they all remember the day of their abortion, that anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
That never goes away. And they always remember, if they were given one, their due date.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these two anniversaries, you know, every year. And, you know, it's very, very difficult. There's nothing more unnatural in the world.
Yeah. And sadly, sometimes women become very hardened, you know, that they've had multiple abortions. But still, even for them, there's always hope, you know, for everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's why it's important that we're there. 50% of the abortions are repeats. So it's like any other sin. Once you commit it, you open yourself up to that, it's easier to go back and do it again. And abortion's the same. And so, you know, we have to remember, this isn't like, well, we'll never see her again. She had the abortion, you know, she didn't come talk to us, and now she's moving on. She could easily be back in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep going out there. And, you know, we've had women who have had 3 or 4 abortions before they just realize, what have I done? I've destroyed my own children. And so it's very powerful to just be present out there.
So Sean, you know, we talked about this earlier, but you wrote this book, The Beginning of the End of Abortion. So why is it that you feel that that's
yeah,
the case?
Well, it was, we were talking about, I had another title that I thought was great, and the editor said, I like it, but what do you want to convey in the book? And I just blurted out, I said, I don't know. I want people to know that we're seeing the beginning of the end of abortion. And she goes, that's the title. And so I was like, well, that was easy. What do we got to do next? Just write it. But it really is. It's not meant to be a provocative title. And it's also not to be some, you know, blind optimism, like everything is great and rosy, because it's not.
There will never be a total end, but
but
at least ending
descriptive.
On demand throughout
Absolutely.
Pregnancy. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
And it's a descriptive. I mean, we are seeing a descriptive title. We're seeing the beginning of the end of abortion. Since 1991, over half of all the abortion facilities have closed in America. So I get into that. I also dig deep into the trends of the abortion industry, how they operate, where their weaknesses are that they admit, not me accusing them of stuff, but where they say we are losing here and here and no one's listening to the warnings. That's very, very powerful. I also get into some of the doctors themselves and some of their comments about the trends within the abortion industry. But this is a hope-filled book. It really focuses on the much larger picture, which is that we have not accepted abortion. It's been legal for 45 years. It was supposed to just go away. And yet the pro-life movement is larger and younger than it's ever been before.
It is. Yeah.
And we now have pregnancy resource centers that outnumber abortion providers 3-1. You know, over 90% of U.S. counties do not have an abortion provider. And it's because of the hearts and minds at the local level. You know, we have science, we have technology, we can see inside the womb and the beautiful ultrasound images. But it's our nature. No one grows up wanting an abortion. No one grows up wanting to be the best abortion doctor in the history of America. It's unlike any other field of medicine. And you know, we have to embrace the fact that the abortion industry has to spend countless hours justifying themselves. And doctors working on, you know, cancer research or heart disease or diabetes, they don't do that. They don't justify themselves.
They're healing.
They don't shrink away when they go to their cocktail parties, you know, but the abortionist does. And that's a great sign for us after 45 years of legalization.
Yeah. And then we've also seen this Dr. Gosnell,
you
know, what he's done, the horror of that facility. And there's a movie, that, you know, and book and so forth. But if you read the book or go to the movie, it's just, or watch the movie.
The movie's very good. It's out October 12th. Hopefully people can see it. And I do a whole chapter on Dr. Gosnell in the context of what he means for the pro-life movement, why he is so important, and it's a beautiful reflection of, you know, this is something all pro-life Americans need to know about.
So real quick, we only have about a minute left. Tell us your website, and if somebody watches this and wants to get really involved, what do they do?
Absolutely. They can go to 40daysforlife.com and find their closest location. If they want the book, they can get a signed copy of the book. The signature doesn't add any value to it. But if you want a signed copy,
it doesn't.
So you can get a signed copy on our website at 40daysforlife.com/book. And you get the book on Amazon. And so people can get it there. But the most important thing is to find your location and take that leap of faith. Say, I'm going to go out for the first time for 10 minutes. I'm going to go out for 30 minutes. I'm going to go out for an hour.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, take that step. This book is filled with people who did just that and didn't really want to.
Yeah, made a huge difference. Well, thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you. Keep up the great work.
We'll be back again next week with the Rooney Report.